The bulletin says that Pat Jones will be wearing a red carnation, but I decided that it would be a good time to save money. You know, Pat. So I suggested to Mary, we just forget it. Easter, as always, was great while it lasted. We had the year's largest crowd. We saw old friends we had not seen in quite a while. And we saw new faces we hoped might be back on the Sunday after Easter. We liked seeing extra chairs in the aisles and the brass quartet on the chancel stage. Now here we are a week later, settled back into mundane parish life. Bulletins and newsletters to print, postcards and phone calls to visitors, words of comfort to the sick and lonely, and the omnipresent, reassuring hum of the copier in the office, without which one wonders how churches ever managed at all. In other words, we have dropped down abruptly by this morning from the holy day high to the ordinary rhythms of congregational life. It's a bit of a letdown, but I remind you that life is filled with those, and we learn to bless and make good use of them. The morning after the party, the settling down to the companionship of marriage after the honeymoon, the less ambitious sermon as the pulse of church life comes back to normal. And speaking of sermons, which is what I meant to do when I launched into all this business about ebb and flow and highs and lows, this is a post-Easter potpourri sermon in which I would like to share several things which have been on my mind. Some important, I think. Some worth no more than a few sentences. Since I think no one is healthy without a sense of humor, so that even churches have to be able to smile at themselves, I'll pass along a joke Jim Giles shared with me on a recent Sunday morning. It's a kind of in-house joke, so if you have never been a Unitarian or a Congregationalist, I need to set you up by telling you that since we do not have a rigid creed with pat answers for all religious questions, our fundamentalist friends like to kid us about what they consider a lack of proper orthodoxy in religion. So the joke is theirs, and the joke is on us. But it's redeemed by cleverness, and I like it. Do you know what you get when you cross a Jehovah's Witness and a Congregationalist? You get a guy who knocks on your door and then doesn't know what to tell you. I would tell you what to tell them, but I don't know either. Item number two in this mix of odds and ends swings from satire to a very serious theological question, which is tucked away in a brief little story I saw the other day in one of my religious journals. It's told in the words of an unusually bright and honest minister who is secure enough to poke a little fun at himself and his church and at the Christian world in general. It will raise an interesting question. What exactly is the difference between those of us who profess to believe in God and those who say quite openly that they do not believe in God at all? Do we, when all is said and done, actually plan our lives in terms of what a Sunday morning God may tell us through prophet, priest, and holy book? Or do we make our weekday plans with absolutely no thought at all of what the will of God may be? Listen carefully to this disturbing little encounter between two Methodists, one a layman and the other the minister I mentioned who is telling the story. It goes like this. The other day I was talking to a man who has become a close friend of a woman who is a communist in the Hungarian government. Have you ever met a real live, lifetime, 100% atheist? He asked me. I mean somebody who is an atheist in the same way I am a Methodist. I confess that I had not. Well, this woman is that kind of person. I thought when I first met her that getting to know somebody who lived her whole life, every minute, every day, without even a thought, not even a hint of God, would be a real revelation for me. I figured that she must be strange, different, like somebody from another planet. You know what I found out? He asked, getting close to my face, gripping me by the collar of my coat. No, what did you find out? I asked. That there's not a damn bit of difference between her and me. She isn't somebody strange. She's just like your average, everyday, common sense American. Like me, she never wonders, what does God want me to do now? Like me, she doesn't lose sleep expecting God to come down and do something about the world. She just goes about her life deciding on the basis of what's in her own best interest, what's practical, what's possible. That little godless communist could pass for you or me anytime. End of story, but there's enough truth in it to bother any one of us who is honest. And one thing a sermon has to do from time to time is bother us a little. Religion really does get watered down in a culture as affluent and comfortable as the one we live in. When I read that piece I just shared with you, I thought of some lines I found in Robert Bella's book called Habits of the Heart, where he's pointing out how shallow and totally self-centered our theology can be. He quotes a young nurse named Sheila, who sums up her insipid faith like this. I believe in God, but I'm not a religious fanatic. I can't remember the last time I went to church. My faith has carried me a long way. It's Sheilaism. Just my own little voice. It's just try to love yourself and be gentle with yourself. You know, I guess, take care of each other. Now, if you can tell me the difference between Sheila and that Hungarian communist we just heard about, I'd like to hear from you. Here's another item from recent reading, but it warmed my heart instead of disturbing it, and we need that too. It seems that a team of evangelical Christians invaded Shipshawana, Indiana. Now, I called our resident Hoosier, Sue Spriggs, to find out if there really is such a place and how to pronounce it. And she didn't know either one. She hadn't heard of it, she said. Left me to my own devices. I did look in an atlas, and there is such a place. I think it has 300 people. Anyway, this team of evangelical, missionary-minded Christians went into this little town to bring the lost of Shipshawana to Christ. In front of Yoder's dry goods store, one of these earnest missionaries confronted a Mennonite farmer with the challenge, "Brother, are you saved?" The old farmer was stunned by the question. All his years of attending the Peach Bloom Mennonite congregation had not prepared him for such a question, particularly right in front of Yoder's store. Wanting not to offend, and believing that the person who posed the question did so with good intentions, he considered seriously how he might answer. After a long pause, the farmer asked his questioner for a pencil and paper and proceeded to list the names of 10 people he believed knew him well. Most of them, he explained, were his friends, but some were less than that and might even be enemies. He suggested that the evangelist ask these people whether they thought him to be saved, since he would not presume to answer such a question on his own behalf. Chalk up another victory for the Mennonites. And feel free to borrow that wise old farmer's solution if you should suddenly be confronted by that very intimate question. And now, finally, I have a different kind of question for you, one which you will not have expected to come from me this morning. It has to do with the building you can see looming up just beyond the windows on my side of this sanctuary. Not everybody voted for that ambitious project, as you might expect would happen in a church made up of free and independent minds. But I sense that even the reluctant are beginning to feel a mounting sense of excitement about the good space that new wing will give us and the beauty it will add to an already beautiful church as it completes the plan we had from the beginning for this place. Any day now, we'll break through into the basement and into the meeting room, and the two houses will join to make one. And we'll be here some Sunday morning soon to find that the walls are bricked and painted white and the whole plant matched up as if we had done it that way back in the winter and spring of 1987. Now, we have known all along that we could not complete Fellowship Hall upstairs without going beyond our own self-imposed debt ceiling, where a spacious kitchen and a high-ceilinged fellowship hall are intended, there will be only an empty shell. It will look attractive from the outside, but inside, our voices will echo rather forlornly. And many of the good things we hope will happen someday in those ground-level rooms will have to wait until we can reduce our debt or find one of those occasional angels who descend on lucky churches with large checks. We have had some of those already, and we had no reason to expect another. But one of them has thought about that unfinished fellowship hall next door and is willing to make a second flight. One of our families, to drop all the analogies and put it bluntly, has promised another $25,000 in immediate cash if the rest of us are willing and able to come up with the remaining $50,000 to complete the project. It has to be cash, or what fundraisers more gently call upfront money, that is payable within the next 3 or 4 weeks if we hope to do the most sensible and economical thing, which is to give the present construction crew the green light to finish the job. It's not going to be the end of the world, or even of our great joy in this church, if it turns out that we simply haven't the will or the wherewithal to do this. I'm sure it would mean for some of us that we drive the present car a year longer than we had planned, or that we vacation in Kansas City instead of in the Caribbean, but it would be somewhere between nice and marvelous if we could do it. As the bulletin says, I will not be present next Sunday. I am donating 3 lectures and a sermon to a church in Dallas over the weekend. But I'll be back by Monday evening, eager to find out whether we are deciding to do this. If we do, the word needs to be passed quickly to John Carraway or Larry Widmer or to our financial secretary, Clint Hufford, in the church office, or even to me, if you don't know the others, because I will instantly pass it on to one of them. 2 gifts of $10,000, 4 of $5,000, and 10 gifts of $1,000, and it would be done. Or to put it another way, it may make some of you more comfortable, if 100 of us gave $500 each, the building would be finished. If we can do it, I will rejoice with all the rest of you, and I promise a comparable sacrifice. If we cannot, if the desire is simply not that strong, then we will respect that and rejoice anyway in all the good things we have done already in this church. You are invited to take a guided tour of the building, the unfinished building, right after church this morning. John Carraway, a member of the building committee, will show you the eagerly awaited and more spacious classrooms and all the nooks and crannies that will shortly become a part of our church life. John will meet you on the gangplank that goes up into the ark. You go up it 2 by 2, both the clean and the unclean. And John will show you around. John does not look much like Noah, but he's very tall and unmistakable, and he'll be delighted to have you come over. I shall miss you next week. Though I confess that the chance to give 3 lectures in the biblical text excite me, I want to urge you to come and bring somebody with you next Sunday to hear another of the splendid youth programs we have been having annually in this church. And I suppose because I'm going to be away from you for a short time, I am moved to say, thank you with all my heart for letting me have the privilege of speaking to you each Sunday.